What's up, everyone? Welcome to this edition of Hiring University. I'm John Beck, your host. Today, we welcome Leonid Igelnik to the show. Leonid and I have a fairly long history, starting when I was his account manager. He was my client, and he used to hold me to the fire for managed hosting services and, God forbid, any downtime that we had when Leonid was running things over at Taleo. Today, Leonid holds a number of different titles, among other things, product development executive, angel investor, startup mentor, advisor, and technology conference and keynote speaker, as well as podcast guest. His last real, air quotes, or full-time job was as executive vice president of engineering at SignalFX, who was acquired in August 2019 for $1 billion. Congratulations, Leonid. Welcome to Hiring University.
Thanks, John. I've been fortunate enough to be at the right place at the right time a couple times. And as you said, built a lot of talent management and HR software. So as a head of engineering, not only had to know a lot about engineering, but to be credible with my customers, had to know a lot about hiring and talent management.
You've built it. You've used it. I think it's fair to say you're a technologist and engineer at heart and at the core. So what I'd like to focus on today is for you to share your insights and perspective and best practices on how to attract talent, because it's still a competitive market, even though there's a lot of unemployed folks and good talent in the market, it's still competitive. How to actually go about hiring in a remote fashion. And then most importantly, how to manage remote teams. And within that conversation, I want to talk about the people element, best practices and tools, and the process, because those are all as important and equally weighted as anything. So let's frame our conversation in that order. How are we going to attract, then hire, and then finally manage those people? When we were talking before we started the show, I was under the assumption that you were always a fan and a proponent of remote work. That's not necessarily the case. Where were you then, and have your opinions changed in the face of COVID-19?
Interesting. Interestingly enough, that's right. I tend to be the old school controversial opinion holder of collocated teams work well and better. And if I had my choice, every single team of mine would be collocated, because there are a lot of interactions that happen when you sit in one room that just don't happen when you're sitting at home. You know, you get to overhear conversations. You have the situational awareness that you generally don't get when you're on Zoom. And people are trying to find out different approaches to compensate for that. But I was always a fan of distributed teams, i.e. leveraging hiring bandwidth and going after different regional locations for the team. Less so bullish on distributed teams individually, especially because most teams, in my experience, don't have a good process to run well collocated. And being distributed requires a completely different level of discipline when it comes to process communication discipline. It's a big challenge for first-time early in career folks, and it's also a big challenge for first-time managers. So that's one of the reasons I was not always for it. But there are exceptions to every rule, right? There's certain types of professionals you can only find where they are, and they're not going to come to you. So you obviously had to learn how to do that. For example, I've done a couple APM products, and in APM, there was this thing called bytecode instrumentation. There are only 120, 150 people in the world know how to do it well. So you have to learn how to work with them. And now we live in exciting new times, which is now you can hire anywhere for a lot of companies, and things are changing as well.
Well, let's hit on that, and I think we're going to go in reverse order, which is fine. It feels like even today there's really two ends of the spectrum. There's those people that have and are probably even more so now been proponents of work from home. There are still some that are resistant, saying as soon as we can get back to the office, we're going to get back. I used to think it was more generationally driven, where older guys like me said, yeah, be in the office because we want to see your face, and that's the way it's always been done. But to your point of a nuanced skill set where there may be only a couple hundred people on the planet that can do the work, you don't have a choice. And now that offices are closed and there's a dearth of talent in cloud engineering and some of the next generation development technologies out there, you have to acquiesce at some point, whether you buy into it or not, in order to get the work done.
Absolutely. And I think you have to acquiesce, but remember that, and we'll see how what happens in this world of exciting world we live in, because even for the folks that I would hire remotely, travel was always an option, right? Meeting people and building relationships is always important. One of my early bosses used to say, don't ask anybody for a professional favor at work before you took them out for lunch, right? And like, figure out how do you get somebody new onboarded who you haven't met in person. And unfortunately, Zoom, in spite of its great capabilities for HD and quality of voice, still lacks that vivid 3D fidelity. And I'm curious to see what's going to emerge to help us build those relationships. I'm actually helping a couple startups right now, and they're prototyping different kinds of Slack bots that create random ad hoc connections between two people that normally don't interact with each other to grab a coffee, virtual coffee or a virtual drink. But it's hard, and you have to be, as a leader of the organization, even more disciplined about remembering the fact that you have somebody who may be out of sight, out of mind. And that's what I told recently a lot of first-time leaders that I'm dealing with. You know, you used to be able to work through the office and realize that somebody's struggling just by watching their body language. How do you figure out somebody's struggling by watching their Slack messages or if they go quiet? So you almost have to like figure out new daily behaviors and new daily routines of checking in with people, engaging who from your team knows how to raise their hand and who doesn't. And that's, I think, even more important for early folks that are early in their career. Because unfortunately, software engineering is not an art, it's not a science, it's a trade. And we as an industry, or as a human race, figured out for millennia how to train tradesmen, right? Your apprentice. And this apprenticeship is typically done by observing and watching. And what do you do if you just graduated from school where you now have to go into an agile ritual, or you need to figure out how to put a PR in place on GitHub, and they don't teach that in school yet?
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And I am a proponent of remote work. We're a virtual remote company. And even 3 years into this venture, we still struggle with a lot of the things that you just talked about. And it because we do miss the organic interaction that happens with people, we're now at a point where we would typically get together every 3 months at the latest, typically every other month or so. We're not going to do that now. And it has spurned a lot of questions in my mind, to your point of how am I going to read people, how they're doing, right? And we have all the, you know, the KPI tools in place, and we know the metrics of when somebody's doing their job or not, but it's the personal issues or whatever's affecting them, or again, reading that body language. Are there best practices out there or technologies? And we mentioned Zoom and Slack, which are all great, but other things that you're seeing out there that can address that?
I think that kind of blew my mind yet. And interestingly enough, as you said in my introduction, I am a technologist at heart. Although for the last 10 years, I've been reading more psychology books than I've been reading technology books. And there's an interesting implication for that in hiring and as well as maintaining the teams, i.e. kind of thinking about your attrition rate. And I've been using tools and techniques that came out of both psychology research, behavioral economics research, to motivate and develop and kind of, as I described to first-time managers, leadership is about getting a large collection of individuals with their own desires and needs rowing roughly into the same direction. You'll never get them on the same vector. You'll be lucky if like the vector is mostly pointing into the right direction. So this is where I'm going right now. I am scouring the literature to see what other techniques I can pick up out of the psychology research or behavioral economics research to get better understanding of how to behave in this situation. Unfortunately, other than improved tooling, and we're so much luckier right now in terms of the timing when this crisis happened, given the kind of collaboration tools we have compared to, let's say, if this happened in the recession of 2008, right? Zoom is reliable. Everybody has decent connection. You know, the exciting thing of, I don't have to invite you into my living room anymore if I don't want to, without having a green screen, just because of the simplicity of a virtual green screen that like tools like Zoom have, which is a big psychological factor, because I've noticed that some folks who did not have the right work environment, who technically now may be working out of the bedroom, are at least comfortable turning the video on so you see the body language and the interaction because of the virtual background capability. I haven't found anything that blew me away yet. So for now, I have to go back to basics And for me, the basics come out of several sources. One of my favorite sources is Daniel Pink's Drive, that talks about the three key things you need to create to motivate a knowledge worker. And I actually use them in both retaining folks and attracting folks, which is autonomy, mastery, and purpose, right? So if you think about creating the environment of autonomy when it comes to remote work, is equipping the folks with the right tools, the right repeatability, the right documentation on internal processes, so they don't constantly feel frustrated about not being able to do their day job, especially if they just joined the organization. So I think the quality of onboarding has to increase substantially to support that level of autonomy.
Yeah.
I think mastery historically been useful for me to both attracting people, and we can talk about as we get to hiring, how I use that aspect to convince the candidate to join for a particular role. But I think about mastery and continuing to invest in it in a remote work will require different types of tools. You know, I speak at a lot of technical conferences, as you mentioned, and even the conferences have now changed. You know, most of my keynotes are done from my office. And how do we make the information and what format of delivery of the content would you use online versus in person so it's more engaging? So I've done a couple conferences where we moved on way past kind of simply talking at people on Zoom. For example, the recorded talk or keynote is done, and then the actual interactive portion with the speakers is Q&A for half an hour while maybe the recording of the talk is playing in the background.
Right.
So there are some interesting innovative formats. And then you have purpose, right? And the purpose motive is very difficult, is even more difficult to create in a distributed environment. It's how do you get people rowing in the same direction towards the same goals? I just saw a startup that I'm advising, for example, launch mini purpose exercises, like a 2-week challenge. Pick a habit, because again, psychology tells us if you want to get regular with a habit, you have to do it 14 times, supposedly. So one of the startups I'm advising just started a 14-day habit, and it can be any habit you want. It could be taking a walk, could be running, or could be playing video games. And how do you self-motivate and equip your teams with techniques to get those habits that they need to acquire that may be difficult for them?
I want to comment on the virtual trade shows. I think a lot of times it's not better or worse, it's different. Everything that
exactly.
We're doing on adapting to it. I've been on some webinars now where they were scheduled previously to be in-person events. I know if it was an in-person event, the keynote would have given their address, walked off the stage, probably hopped in an Uber or Lyft, and no chance for me to connect with them. Versus the virtual, they actually open up for Q&A and there's a chance for some dialogue. So again, it's different. Let me hit on different with the actual interview process. You built great teams at SignalFX and Taleo and other stops along the way. That too is different. And some people are much better in person than they are on the phone or video, right? We've all experienced that.
Yep.
You can't do a whiteboard session. Panel interviews go away now. People are suffering from video fatigue or they're concerned about their environment. How do you adapt to that through that process to find people to cut through all the differences, but also to make sure that they're capable of work from home? Because it takes a certain personality and maturity to do that.
You know, it's interesting with video interviews, because folks historically always done a video interview as at least a form of screen and pre-screen. And I'm a huge fan, just because I had to hang out around a lot of my Taleo customers, of doing a lot of early pre-screens over voice. It takes a lot of kind of prejudgment out of the conversation when you just focus on the voice rather than the appearance, the background, or even some basic things like an eye contact. So right now, and for most folks, I have a choice. I can look at you, John, and your video back. So as a human, I'm used to interacting with a face. Mm-hmm. Or I can help you and look at the camera so you can see me looking at you. And just even that skill of knowing where to look when you look when you're on video.
Yes.
Is this new difficult thing. And I don't know if you've seen, there are some interesting products that I've seen come out that I think in video, somebody released a product that finds the eyes on the picture and automatically regazes you towards the video camera. So it looks to the person you're talking to that you're actually looking at them, not at their picture on the screen, which is fairly below you, right? So remembering that we're still learning how to behave on video is, I think, one tip for both folks being interviewed and interviewing and determining where you look. Number two, some fundamentals. And I am a photographer. I've been doing photography since I was 8. So some basic lighting condition when you show up for the interview. If you want your party to see you, well, don't put a window behind you so you're like a nice silhouette as if you are in a 60-minute interview, you know, masked with a distorted voice. Invest in a good, decent quality microphone or headsets, like even AirPods Pro, just something that is better than a built-in mic into your microphone. Because again, research demonstrates that for humans to be engaged, speech is much more important than video. You can have pretty crappy video and you still will follow the other party. Yes. But if you have crappy voice, like forget about it, right? So focusing on that, and then for the interviewers, and it just blows my mind that companies still do that, this virtual on-site concept that a lot of companies basically used to do an on-site 5-6 hours in a row, people rotating in and out, and they just taken that format and transplanted it as is. And you mentioned this, the video fatigue, right? And I'm shamelessly stealing this term from you. It is much harder to be engaged with a flat screen over six hours of conversations. So my other advice is break it up and probably no more than two hours in a row.
Yes.
And like, there's no reason right now to do that. And quite frankly, I would argue for people scheduling interviews, you all of a sudden got a flexibility. And instead of trying to get everybody in the same room at the same time, you now have greater flexibility from a candidate and greater flexibility from an interview panel. So I was blown away when I didn't see companies embrace it.
Yeah, I'm with you. The video fatigue for all of us is real, certainly during an interview process, which is stressful enough as it is. I have seen some early rumblings around virtual reality being used for interviews and whatnot, just to give people to break up that monotony and to have more of the 3D type effect. It'd be interesting to see where that goes. Let me take a step even further back in the chain. And I made some earlier comments that there are some in the recruiting world that believe there's just so much talent on the market because of the layoffs. It's that much easier to find really good software engineers. I personally disagree with that. I think yes, there's more talent, but it is as fiercely competitive as ever. VC activity has slowed a little, but still very active. If you read the dailies, there's deals getting done every day. How do you, and you consult with a lot of startups, how do you attract and compete and differentiate yourself knowing that that's the case? And the big guys are taking advantage of this too, right? All the FANG stocks are gobbling up talent right away. How does a startup compete?
That's right. I absolutely agree with you. In spite of talent being available, what I've learned over the years is, you know, if there was a 2 million shortage of software engineers worldwide, well, maybe, you know, let's go to the extreme and say now there's a 500,000 person shortage in our industry.
Yeah.
Still 500,000 shortage in our industry. Right. So, and I agree with you. I think the competition is different. As you said, in this type of economy, the candidate pool becomes more risk averse. And they are possibly more, like the larger companies, more stable companies, maybe more appealing to them. So if you were a startup, I think you have to compete. And maybe that's what forces you to go remote. For example, at SignalFX, even in a thriving economy where people were open to go work at the startup, we ended up opening a site elsewhere. And for me, the appeal is threefold or fourfold. I think it's the new concept that I'll introduce. I call it arbitrage. You have to create an arbitrage on something. For example, when SignalFX went to open an office in Krakow, we were the coolest company in town. Mm. We were able to bring the kind of engineering culture and work that not a lot of other companies in town had. And we were milking that arbitrage of being a Silicon Valley company, behaving like Silicon Valley. And I think if you're looking at talent pools outside of Silicon Valley, and I've lived in 5 different countries. I worked professionally in 3, Israel, Canada, and here in California, in US, you have an opportunity to bring slightly different technology quality and cultural norms to regions where you can benefit from that arbitrage, right? It will only appeal to a certain type of candidate, but you will find those types of candidates. For example, I see companies going to Toronto, both for time zone variation as well as immigration law flexibility, so you can have choices between Canada and US. But Toronto is full of banks and insurance companies and maybe a few cool product development companies. There's like a bit of Google, tons of Shopify, a bit of Atlassian. So going to places where you may be a cool employer for people that already live there and don't want to move. Specifically, I would be targeting places like Austin, Pittsburgh, anything around good technology university, right, is always helpful. So that's one. So whatever arbitrage you can find, and that arbitrage, by the way, depends on the product you're selling. Because to me, recruiting, and John, you come out of sales, you know that recruiting is selling a different product. So arbitrage is number one. Number two, I'll go back to the same principles I mentioned before, which is autonomy, mastery, and purpose. Understanding candidates' desires and understanding their career aspiration 5 years from now has been the biggest impactor for me on being able to convince somebody to join a given company, because that allows me to tell a story when we come with an offer, if we get to that stage, about why does this job versus maybe other jobs you have on the market help you get to your goal closer. So if I understand the goals, I can at least articulate that as a hiring manager. And I tend to articulate it around autonomy, mastery, and purpose, right? Situationally, depending on the candidate, what are they going to learn from joining us? What are they bringing to the table? Why it's an interesting goal that they can line up with, especially remote. It's much harder to stay connected to the company. And again, talk about autonomy and tools that we have. Like, I'm huge fan of efficient onboarding. On my teams, an engineer has to commit something that goes to production. I mostly do SaaS stuff, so production is kind of very close to the engineering team. By day five on the job, it's the small thing that matters, but it increases your level of engagement. And by the way, it drives referrals, because I know more companies that cannot onboard you this efficiently than can.
Yeah, don't get me started. Yeah.
Getting that endorphin shot, right, yeah, of day one HR, day two my workstation, day three learn about the architecture, day four or five fix, doesn't matter however trivial bug you fixed, right? Even as a senior engineer, and senior guys realize, like, yeah, just change the label.
You got to win, you contributed.
That's right. It's that little, like, I've done something in my first week, which is pretty cool, that tends to also be differentiator. And you can talk about that. Like, that's arbitrage. And that's one of the reasons I mentioned that I think quality of onboarding in this remote work has to increase even more than what it was before.
That's an interesting set of answers. You may or may not realize this, but as a technologist, the three things that you just recited have nothing really to do with technology at all. More to do with psychology than anything.
Oh, I absolutely realize that. And that's why at some point when I professionally moved from architecting systems to architecting teams, I realized that the operating system for architecting teams has nothing to do with technology. It has to do everything with psychology.
Right. And I'll go on my 5-second rant here. This is our frustration in our industry, where so many companies believe, I have the job description with my list of requirements. Go find me the body. I don't have time to talk to you about how my company is different, how we're doing things with onboarding, how I'm going to create, you know, positive referrals. All those things get missed. They really believe that here's the requirements, go find the body, which is the failure of this industry. You know, it's not just about pattern matching a bunch of keywords. It's about understanding people and motivation and matching those between buyer and seller. So anyways, I digress.
No, John, and I have to agree with you. And that's one of the reasons I know I've been personally successful attracting top talent is, as you probably know from your background in sales, in order to win, you don't need to be better. You need to be different, right? You have to stand out from bazillion inbounds every skilled engineer gets on their LinkedIn. And in order to stand out, you have to understand psychology more so than technology. Now, you can leverage technology and differentiation in your company, on your product, when it comes to pitching mastery or purpose. For example, when SignalFX entered Poland, I was a company that was doing 1 trillion messages over Kafka bus in a day, anywhere from 5 million to 25 million messages a second. That's something I can peak in interest with. Yeah, I don't know
that's
if
a glamour stat. Absolutely.
I cannot close an engineer with that, right? So understanding what arbitrage or what sexy qualities the company can bring to the table, because, you know, I spent most of my professional career in enterprise software, and enterprise software is as sexy as plumbing, as well as lucrative as plumbing. I know how much I paid my plumber last time. So it makes it difficult to attract. So for the folks that you work with that get it, I think they will be able to get disproportionately better quality of talent because they will look different.
Let me shift gears here for a second and let's talk a little bit about Leonid. You look at a lot of deals, you follow technology. What's around the corner that excites you the most?
So I've been fortunate enough to be at the right place at the right time 23 years ago when SaaS as a concept for delivering software got started before even SaaS was nailed SaaS. And it was interesting to see the evolution of the SaaS industry. So, John, when you and I met back in 07, 08, people were still telling me, it's like, yeah, this whole SaaS thing is a fad. We will never put our data in your cloud. So I think we finally moved on past that. I think for me, the next interesting evolutionary trends in an enterprise software segment of the market have to do with two different interesting trends. Number one, emergence of the cloud as de facto the standard way of delivering technology solutions. Like cloud, just a much more efficient compute market. Somebody like Zoom, who had to grow 10, 20 times overnight, was able to get that compute from probably other customers of their cloud vendors that had to shed that compute because their business was disproportionately affected. Imagine if that compute was locked up in physical data centers and inaccessible. So just a much more efficient marketplace.
Yes.
Number two, what I like about what we're seeing in the industry through emergence of major cloud providers, as well as emergence of standardization of infrastructure management APIs, like Kubernetes, we see in standardization of delivery models and new SaaS delivery models emerging. Actually, one of the companies I just invested money in and became an advisor company called SpeedScale, which wrote a blog on SaaS 2.0, where if you're familiar with, for example, how Databricks delivers their software, they have control plane running in their cloud, and they will use the standard APIs that all cloud providers now give with standardization of Kubernetes to run the data plane, the bulk of the compute, in the customer's VPC. It's better for privacy. It's better for data residency. We're not moving data back and forth needlessly between the clouds. And quite frankly, it's more economically...
Or paying for it.
Or exactly. And quite frankly, it's much more economically efficient because now all of a sudden the SaaS provider is not any longer in the business of reselling compute from Amazon, right? So that's one trend that I think is going to be interesting, and we'll see a new type of applications emerge and possibly also unlock domains that were remained locked to SaaS vendors because of data privacy. Mm. The second big trend that I am excited about is application of machine learning techniques to human productivity. I took a sabbatical before my SignalFX job, and I decided to learn a bit more ML, and I trained a neural net to play Snake 5 different ways, just to kind of get a feel for that. Watching, I'm advising a couple companies that are playing in natural language processing space. Watching the speed with which that space moved from LSTMs to transformers to Google recently released a new natural language processing model called BERT. It's pretty exciting. And I think the next major inflection point in productivity of humans is not necessarily replacing humans. I think it's augmenting humans through machine learning enabled applications. And I think I've been greatly disappointed by AR, VR. I thought that would be the next revolution, and it still fizzled out. We'll see if VR gets a boost from kind of the current situation. But I'm bullish on SaaS 2.0 and ML.
Well, if you're a young software engineer just entering the market, right, put yourself in the Wayback Machine. What does a young Leonid share with, or what does the Leonid today share with a young Leonid or an entry-level employee coming into the marketplace based on what you know today?
Three things. Don't forget about your soft skills. Software is built by teams of humans, not by individuals, especially software of any kind of meaning. And you have to learn how to collaborate with those humans, especially in this day and age of remote work, right? That will stretch you even more. Believe it or not, John, I am an introvert and a trained extrovert. So, you know, early in pandemic, me, my glass of cognac, and my Netflix shows were quite okay for a few weeks until, you know, I needed some human interaction. Second is remember that software engineering is not just science, it's a trade, and learn the tools of the trades. So GitHub, all the common tool chains, learn more about the cloud. The good news is things are so accessible right now in terms of online tutorials, online content, that you should be able to learn, and that goes to learn how to learn. I've been in this industry for 23 years, and the way we build software today is not the way we built software 10 years ago, and then it changed again. It will keep changing. And the last one, I think, because I'm so excited about machine learning, don't neglect your math studies and in school. I think, you know, I've studied calculus and differential equations and have not used any of those concepts. But they all of a sudden needed to be used as I was relearning or reacquainting myself with modern machine learning techniques, because most of those are based on math, or as my former chief scientist from SignalFX would say, basic math. And even if you're not going to become a statistician or mathematician, understanding some of those basic techniques and concepts, I think, will allow you to participate in more exciting projects in the next 5 to 10 years.
So you're still a believer of the traditional educational system going and getting your undergraduate degree as opposed to just venturing out into the workforce? Because there's a big movement now to say, waste of money, go and, you know, take on an apprenticeship, learn how to develop. You don't necessarily agree with that, or do you?
I think both have a place in the industry. I think it will lead to a different career path. I have benefited from fairly deep education on fundamentals at a place like Technion in Israel, where I can still talk to you how things work at the silicon level, at the inside the processor, and how a line of Java code or high-level code translates to that. And there are times and products and opportunities that require that level of understanding. There are plenty of other jobs that will make you successful that don't require that level of understanding. I think the key thing I got out of school is not the things they taught me, is the ability to learn. And I think whether you go through a boot camp or whether you go through a university degree, the key things to learn is how to learn, because this industry changes every few years. New tools, languages, frameworks, techniques emerge, and you have to keep up or you're simply going to be left behind.
I agree with that. And I tell kids that I am involved with, you go to college more so than anything to learn how to learn. So I think that's really, really good wisdom. By the way, we will have to find another time to talk about being a trained extrovert and how you accomplish that. I don't think we have enough time today, but that's a fascinating concept. It's probably back to the 14 days of habits or longer. But way longer.
Yeah,
but you would never know it. Lena, listen, really, really good stuff. Appreciate you spending time with us. Before we go, tell our listeners where they can connect with you online if they're looking to contact you for investment or advisement or otherwise.
So you can find me in two fundamental places. I'm on Twitter at LEGolnik, LIGOLNIK, or you can just follow me on LinkedIn. Every once in a while, I'll share a thought or an article that I find interesting there. You don't have to be connected to me to still benefit from some of the thoughts I put online. I'm from the class of people that curate their LinkedIn framework. So if you send me a simple connection request, don't expect an immediate return. But if you want to get my opinion on something, you want to ask me a question, LinkedIn or Twitter are the best places.
Terrific. Again, Lena, thanks for stopping by. Continue to be safe. And for our listeners, until next time, keep grinding and keep the faith.